The year is 2040. Sea level is on the rise. By 2100, up to 70 million people could be impacted by flooding. We're seeing a lot fewer cold days. And a lot more hot ones.
The water.
In 2040, as many as 750 million people living in cities will regularly deal with severe drought. That sounds pretty bad, right? Well, that's because the average global temperature has gone up by a whopping 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit since the Industrial Revolution. Without serious work by the international community, it's likely things will get much worse. Global temperatures could increase up to 3.6 degrees by the end of the century. And that means higher sea level rise, more heat waves and massive storms, likely no Arctic sea ice in the summer, and many more people living with little access to food and water. And the cost of dealing with a 3.6 degree increase, $64 trillion worldwide. These doomsday scenarios are not from a mega disaster Hollywood movie. It's according to a new report on climate change commissioned by the United Nations. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today, one of the most important stories of our time that somehow keeps falling off the front page. Climate change. So let's talk about what happens next. We have two voices to help us with that. Megan Mullen is an associate professor of environmental politics at Duke University. Megan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Hello.
And Mark Jacobson is a professor and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Mark, the first question for us non-scientists, does this report change our understanding of the speed and scope of climate-related dangers? Basically, I want to know, why don't more people care, Mark?
Well, I don't think it changes from the scientific point of view what we already knew. It just brings forward and makes it more public what a lot of scientists have known and really adds more detail. You know, people, I think, do care. A lot of people do care, but a lot of people just don't know what to do about it. And so that's part of what I try to do is try to make it easier for people to understand what they can do to try to solve the problem.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that from your perspective, Mark, is that when we were thinking about this, I thought, well, a lot of people are using paper straws, for example, and they're using nylon bags instead of plastic bags. Is that enough? Is that not enough? What are some of your solutions from a scientific perspective?
Well, most of the problem stems from too much emission from combustion, from burning things like oil, gas, and coal, and also even some biofuels and for energy. So we really need to change the energy infrastructure of the world to try to electrify everything. So instead of using gas heaters in our homes, we'd use electric heat pumps for air heating and water heating and air conditioning. So a lot of people can do a lot of things in their own lives to a transition, but what is also needed are policies put in place at the government level. And this is happening in a lot of places worldwide. I mean, California just passed a law that everything has to go to renewable energy in terms of their electric power by the year 2045, with 60% by 2030. And there are six countries of the world that run on almost 100% clean renewable energy already out of 195 countries of the world.
But we're going to take a look at some of those in a minute. But you mentioned policy, and that's where I want to bring in Megan here, because Megan, I think this is something that's become extremely politicized, this being climate change. Do we have any reason to believe that this report will actually result in change from our government, all the things that Mark just lined up, particularly when it comes to industry?
There are different governments, right? So it's hard to be optimistic that this will produce immediate change at the federal government level. But there are a lot of changes happening at the subnational level in the United States, in cities, in states. It's a difficult problem at the federal level. All of the barriers to solving political problems in the United States right now are more pronounced for climate change than for just about any other issue, right? The partisan differences on this issue are severe. The regional impacts of solutions are pronounced and variable. And there's not a large constituency of Americans right now for whom this is the most important problem to solve.
Now, I have to ask you there. This is an issue, as we just outlined at the beginning of the very top of the show, that will affect everyone, regardless of where you live and who you are. How is it that we continue to be in a disconnect, understanding that some of this is politically driven? But you just mentioned the natural disasters. I mean, these are things that have happened to all Americans, not just some Americans. Why are we still experiencing this disconnect? Has the politics really taken over to the point where we don't see a solution to this?
Well, it's difficult for people to connect their personal experiences, which, as you say, are happening right now, right? Eastern North Carolina, the western United States that's being impacted by fires, communities around the United States that are experiencing water scarcity or heat waves, right? So people are experiencing impacts right now, but it's difficult for them to connect those personal experiences with this abstract phenomenon.
Mark, when you hear Megan say that, I'm wondering how it looks to you as a scientist, why you think we haven't seen more political action towards climate change policies in this country.
I have a slightly different view because I agree that there is a disconnect when we talk about climate policy about what people want. In fact, there was a public opinion poll, large public international public opinion poll that says only 66% of people believe that climate change is a serious international problem. And that's pretty sad that only 66% believe that. However, the good news was over 82% of the people of the world, this was a poll of 26,000 people in 13 countries, believe that the world should transition to 100% clean renewable energy. So people do not necessarily believe in climate change, but they do believe in a transition to clean renewable energy. And you could even see that in the United States. I mean, 9 out of the 10 top wind states in the United States are all in Republican-led states. And there are over 80 cities and towns that have committed to 100% clean renewable energy. There are 140 international companies, including all the large companies of the world, have committed to that. So I think the key is not to talk about climate change. The reason people believe in clean renewable energy and not necessarily about climate change is because they think that clean renewable energy will create more energy independence, will reduce air pollution problems. People are more concerned about air pollution than they are about climate. It'll create more stable energy supplies in the long run. And also, it brings costs down. I mean, the two cheapest forms of new electric power in the United States today are onshore wind and large-scale solar power. And they're half the cost of natural gas. So the reason people are transitioning, despite their non-belief in climate change, is because it's cheaper and it's getting cheaper by the day.
But that appears to be, and it continues to feel like a major disconnect between, you just mentioned, Mark, that Republican states are some of the ones that have the best wind and renewable energy resources right now. That seems very much in contrast, at least with what President Trump was saying, pumping up things like coal country, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So he's talking a lot against it. But the fact is, because the economics are so good, people are transitioning in any case. Despite all his rhetoric, coal plants are still being shut down.
What about big business, Megan? I'm curious if you can help us understand that a little bit. Where do they play into this narrative about climate change?
Well, they exert a lot of influence on our politics, right? And the industry structure and our political structure is still favoring the businesses that have historically dominated the energy industry. And so in order to convert the sort of individual activities and the economic activities that Mark was describing before, in order to convert that into policy activity, then these businesses need to exert political voice. And so far, there's been some hesitation to do that.
Why is that?
I think a lot of it is that it is this sort of emerging industry, right? So there are lots of different players. It's not concentrated in a few actors. But that's part of what needs to happen, right? Exercising our voices and saying this is an issue we need you to prioritize, right? It's not just a concern, one of many, but it has to be the top concern for politicians looking to set their agendas, right?
And because we're not seeing many of them in the lead up to the midterm elections really putting this at the top of their agenda.
They're not, right? And right now, there's not a lot of political cost in ignoring it.
Mark, I'm wondering, we sort of touched on this, but I'm wondering what can everyday, average, non-governmental decision-making Americans do here? Those of us who are thinking we're doing the right thing by using the nylon bags and the plastic the not plastic straws, et cetera, et cetera. What can we do, if anything? This is a problem that feels way bigger than us, but I know people want to do better. How can they?
Well, there are basic things. I mean, there are, throughout the United States, there are what are called community choice aggregation utilities cropping up. You can actually choose to have a utility that actually provides all its electricity from clean renewable energy, up to 100% of its electricity from wind and solar and geothermal power. So that's an option that a lot of people should take. I mean, and the price of electricity is virtually the same. It's really virtually the same in most places. If it's different, it might be different by 0.01 cents per kilowatt hour, just a tiny amount. So that's one thing. But then you could also power your own home. So a lot of people are putting solar on their own roofs, batteries in their garages. And anything in your home that uses gas, such as a stove, go to induction cooktop stoves. I mean, they're amazing. They boil water in half the time as a gas stove, even. In terms of cars, go to electric cars. I mean, their range is now 300 miles and more. And weatherizing your home, making sure you don't have losses of heat. Energy efficiency is the cheapest form of energy savings.
I'm going to keep these things in mind, Mark, as I am now shopping for appliances myself. So I appreciate right. that. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and the director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. And Megan Mullen is an associate professor of environmental politics at Duke University. Thanks to you both.
Well, thanks for having us on the show.
And we want to hear from you. With the midterms just weeks away, do you consider climate change a top voting issue? Why or why not?
I'm Terry, and I'm from out here in Oregon. Climate change is always a priority when voting. I have a daughter that works in climate science, and the newest UN reports prove that Trump and his cronies are absolutely wrong. We need more science, more help, more support, more planning for the inevitable that climate change is bringing us. Our paradigms must change.
Hi, this is Milt Lee from Cass Lake, Minnesota. Climate change is number one, first, and always. If we don't deal with climate change, what else is there?
Hi, this is Leanne from Central Illinois. My number one issue in November would be term limits. My number two issue is money and lobbying. And to focus on guns or the environment or abortion or any of the other hot issues would be to ignore the forest.
This is Jim from Walterboro, South Carolina. There's nothing we humans can do about the climate change anyway. Scientists are wrong with this fact. Mother Nature has already started her adjustments, and things will be changing.
Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE to weigh in or tweet us at The Takeaway.
It has been an honor of a lifetime. I am such a lucky girl to have been able to lead the state that raised me and to serve a country I love so very much.
Here's another shakeup in the Trump administration. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley has resigned. She'll be staying at the post through the end of the year. The former Tea Party candidate has long been considered one of the more stable figures in the administration, representing some of the more traditional U.S. interests on the world stage, as President Trump pushed his hard-lined America First agenda. Here's the former ambassador speaking earlier today from the White House.
Look at the 2 years. Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through, and the president proved that.
Ambassador Michael McFaul served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from January 2012 to February 2014.
I'm surprised by it. I didn't expect it. Usually ambassadors to the United Nations serve 4 years terms, and that they decided to do this announcement before the midterms, even though she said she's going to serve to the end of the year. I think the timing is very strange, and I listened to her announcement, sitting chatting with the president very jovially, but I think there must be much bigger causes at play here, and I look forward to learning more about what happened.
What would you say were some moments that stood out for her and maybe some places where she had some challenges?
Well, to me, Ambassador Haley, whether it's moderate or not, that will depend on your perspective. But I saw her as a pretty conventional thinker and voice for American national security interests. She valued alliances. She wanted to push back on Iran and North Korea. She talked democracy and human rights on Russia. She was a strong voice pushing back on Russia. And in a different administration, that would seem very normal and nothing particular about that. In the Trump administration, it seemed extraordinary because the president had so many different views on those things, particularly with respect to working with our allies, and particularly with respect to Russia, and particularly with respect to democracy and human rights, where they were oftentimes at odds on those sets of issues. So I see her as representing a lot of continuity in American foreign policy, but serving a president that does not.
You've mentioned that Ambassador Haley had been outspoken on human rights compared to others in the administration, but she's also defended President Trump multiple times, perhaps most notably when he was laughed at during his UN speech. I'm wondering if you know anything about their relationship, the relationship between Ambassador Haley and President Trump.
Well, of course she did, and that's what any ambassador serving the president should do. But let's be clear, she's resigning. Like, maybe that says something about how she really felt about the president and the policy. And, you know, in the press conference, it was very strange, I thought, all the praiseworthy language back and forth. I think over time, we'll probably learn that there was much more, oftentimes there were disagreements, both about the substance and about the style of conducting American foreign policy. And if there wasn't, why is she resigning now? It makes absolutely no sense to me otherwise.
Well, those cordial words are actually interesting, given a 2016 tweet from the president where he says the people of South Carolina are embarrassed by Nikki Haley.
Well, that's right. I'm an expert on foreign policy, not American electoral politics. But I just find the timing to be extremely bizarre, number one. And number two, I just think it means a shift away from what I think is more kind of sensible middle-of-the-road foreign policy, where we've had consensus about working with our allies and talking about our values. And Ambassador Haley, I think, reflected that consensus in at a time when the president doesn't. And I worry we're going to veer even further away from what I think are important things to stand up for.
Ambassador Michael McFaul served as U.S. ambassador to Russia from January 2012 to February 2014. Ambassador, thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We continue now with our coverage of Abandoned in America, a new series from the Center for Public Integrity that looks to shine a light on some of the poorest communities in the United States. Just months after the President's Council of Economic Advisers declared that the war on poverty was largely over. That narrative neglects the stories of countless Americans still struggling under crushing economic conditions. And today we turn to a community in North Carolina where natural disasters and poor governmental response have exposed the depth of that suffering.
Hello, my name is Columbus Benjamin Howard, Jr., better known by some as Chris Howard. I live in Lumberton, North Carolina. I'm also a city councilman here in Lumberton, going through my first term and having been through two storms, major storms.
Hurricane Florence made landfall in the Carolinas last month, and the devastation brought back painful memories from just 2 years earlier when Hurricane Matthew tore through the area, the first Category 5 Atlantic hurricane in nearly 10 years. For residents of Lumberton, North Carolina, in rural Roberson County, the devastation was inescapable.
With Florence, it affected everyone, whereas Matthew only affected mostly southwest Lumberton. In Florence, it affected basically everybody, but what they don't understand, if God made it rain for 40 nights and 40 days and it flooded the earth, we had 5 days of continuous rain.
It was just deja vu for these residents. The damage was just horrible.
That's Ashley Balserzak, a federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. And I talked to her about reporting in Lumberton and whether or not residents' stories were reflected in the rosy economic picture touted by the Trump administration.
Lumberton, North Carolina, it's one of the most diverse rural counties in the country, actually. You have about a third white, a third black, a third Lumbee Native American, and a growing Hispanic population. So it's a very interesting kind of makeup there.
And of course, we're looking at this series through the sort of idea that the President of the United States has recently said that we solved the war on poverty, that we're good when it comes to poverty. But Lumberton is actually one of the poorest and unhealthiest and most dangerous counties in North Carolina. Tell us about what that looks like.
Yeah, so I visited twice this summer and this fall, first to kind of see what the town looked like after being hit by Hurricane Matthew in 2016. And you could still see a lot of the destruction from that long ago. You would see piles of sand that had come from under the river that people hadn't cleared out, still some furniture laying out, some houses that just were very dilapidated, and some areas where they had already torn down the entire house and there was just a green space.
And what about the impact of Hurricane Florence?
Yeah, so they got pummeled again almost 2 years to the day, which was just horrible because when I was there in July, you would still see all of this destruction, but I was talking to a lot of people who were finally getting their lives back together. One woman, I saw her the day that she got into her new home that was just rebuilt. And then Florence hit and the same thing happened all over again. Her house was flooded. And I heard that story time and time again.
And are there any people or groups in particular that these residents would like to see more from? I'm wondering about FEMA or any other organizations.
FEMA's been on the ground. Red Cross has been on the ground. There was an issue with Hurricane Matthew, with HUD money, with housing and urban development money that hadn't come through from the state. I think about 10% of the money that was gifted from the federal government was actually distributed. So people are saying, well, okay, the money hasn't come that time around, then, and that's 2 years later. So what's going to happen with Hurricane Florence money? How is that going to work?
So Chris Howard, the Lumberton resident we heard from earlier, echoed those same concerns in trying to get help rebuilding his house.
The sad part about it is the money has been there years ago, but the body in Raleigh, the legislative body, it was delayed and delayed and delayed. So now they're just beginning to get to that mitigation stage. With Florence, we don't know what is going to happen because they're telling me that there is nothing that they can do except for whatever they registered for Matthew.
I talked to many residents that, one, either were too discouraged to even apply for aid because they were told that they would never get it. Denials are very frequent. FEMA admits that, and they say, you just have to apply again. But that's really discouraging to residents. One person that I spent a lot of time with, Ms. Diane Powell, she actually went back and forth with FEMA 12 different times, talking to different representatives, having to tell her story again, hearing conflicting things. You need this piece of information, you need this, to the point where she just gave up on that process. So the recovery for a lot of people that need it the most, that were really hit badly and are in shelters or staying with family members, the system isn't really working for them in the way that it's meant to.
This is a district that was reliably Democratic, but did end up voting for President Trump, who has said, as we mentioned earlier, that the war on poverty is over. Is that a disconnect for the residents of Lumberton?
Well, so at the time, it was very interesting. As I said before, just showing up matters. And during the hurricane, a lot of the people that I talked to said, we saw Donald Trump's bus. We saw the big name Trump on the side of the bus. We saw Laura Trump passing out water bottles to us. And that was really memorable. And we didn't see Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump also was kind of talking to the points that really resonated with Robesonians, such as I'm going to get rid of NAFTA. A lot of people say took a ton of the manufacturing jobs out of the county. I'm not sure how much they think that he's held up their promises, but at the time he seemed to be speaking right to them.
And where does Lumberton go from here? Obviously, there are midterm elections coming up in a couple of weeks. You know, there's probably still a lot more recovery to be done. Where do they go from here?
Yeah, so that's something I was trying to piece together when I was there, because you still have hundreds of people in shelters, and maybe voting is the last thing on their minds, or they weren't really politically engaged to begin with. That's one of the reasons we chose Robeson County. They have a very low turnout rate. You're trying to rebuild. You may not be living in your house. You may be with a family member. So Board of Elections are saying, well, we can send you an absentee ballot. You can vote from anywhere. We're sending them to shelters. We've extended the voter registration date by 3 days. But people are that I talk to are saying, well, I don't know if these measures are enough. So it'll be interesting to see who does come out for this election, if they're angry enough with being hit twice in 2 years and don't feel like they've been paid attention to, if that will matter, or if, again, they're just going to be struggling to stay afloat.
Ashley Balzerzak is a federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Ashley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can find a link to the Abandoned in America project from the Center for Public Integrity at thetakeaway.org.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free, Babbel.com.
I stand before you today on the heels of a tremendous victory for our nation, our people, and our beloved Constitution.
At a rally this weekend, President Trump celebrated the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The president called it a victory for our nation and our people. And last night, he apologized to Kavanaugh for what he and his family had gone through during the process.
What happened to the Kavanaugh family violates every notion of fairness, decency, and due process. Our country, a man or a woman, must always be presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty. And with that, I must state that you, sir, under historic scrutiny, were proven innocent.
To be clear, Kavanaugh was not proven innocent or guilty through any process, and there are many Americans who feel ignored and dismissed by the president. But what is clear is that the Kavanaugh nomination is the latest example of the fury, anger, and even contempt among not just our political leaders, but many Americans. People on both sides of the political spectrum are increasingly angry and distrusting of each other. And frankly, a lot of that is driven by pundits on social media and on cable news.
All the Democrats have is lying and deception, and this is all they have in the toolbox.
I want the Democrats to blitz every down, because that's what the Republicans do.
Screaming mobs of child activists scare normal people who are watching at home.
Local news covered rallies of women supporting Kavanaugh. Do they go out and support someone accused of murder or arson?
What are they going to run on? We're going to hike your taxes, we're going to take your health care and send your kids to a crap school? What's their campaign side for 2020 now, other than illegal immigrants, please vote for us?
So how did we get to a point where it feels like each side has such deep-seated contempt for the other, particularly around an issue as emotional and deeply personal as sexual harassment and assault? Liliana Mason is going to help us figure that out. She's an assistant professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland and the author of Uncivil Agreement: How Politics Became Our Identity. Liliana, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really hope you can help us make some sense out of this, because I don't know if it's just me, but it feels as though contempt between Democrats and Republicans is perhaps at its highest point, or am I wrong?
Yeah, so in sort of the years that we have data for, which basically goes back to 1950, We have seen increases in dislike for the other party. So no matter which party you're in, you dislike the other party more. We've seen increases in levels of anger at the other party. And we've also seen increases in levels of enthusiasm for people's own party.
So this doesn't seem like a relationship that's really going to work out.
No. The part of the problem is that the parties are starting to feel very different from each other culturally and socially. And that really is driving a lot of this sense of sort of distance from each other.
Okay, all of us can sort of assume why we think this is happening, but what does your research show? What are some of these main issues that are leading to this intense animosity?
So the interesting thing that I've found is that it's not actually issues. It's really, really based in social identities. And so what happened was that during the 1970s and 80s, we had what political scientists call cross-cutting identities. So there were people who are in different parties but might go to the same church or might be neighbors. And what we've seen really since the 90s and early 2000s is that Democrats and Republicans have been sorting themselves into very, very socially different groups. So they tend to live in different neighborhoods. Democrats are generally the party of non-white people, while Republicans are the party of mostly white people. Republicans are mostly Christian. Democrats represent sort of everyone else. And increasingly, Republicans are more male, and the gender gap is growing between the parties. There's also cultural differences, geographical differences like rural and urban. Over and over with all these different groups that people belong to, over the last few decades, it's become clearer to voters which party they belong in based on which social group they're already in.
So let's say that that's in fact the case. Do we have to be so contemptuous of each other? And last week when protesters confronted various senators in the hallways to really implore them to believe Christine Blasey Ford, for example, and other victims, there was a scene in which one protester confronted Senator Orrin Hatch.
Why aren't you brave enough to talk to us and exchange it with us? Don't you wave your hand at me. I wave my hand at you.
When you grow up,
when I grow up,
we grow up.
You
and I grow up.
How dare you talk to women that way? How dare you?
They're yelling at him, and you hear angry protesters. And his response is, you know, and I'm quoting here, he says, when you grow up, I'd be glad to. And then he sort of waves them away. I'm wondering if we've lost the common bottom line when it comes to governance in terms of decency, at least the appearance that you are listening to other folks who may not be in your party.
So one really important thing that identity does for people is that it connects to their sense of self-esteem, which makes it extremely important that your group wins. Because if your group loses, you feel like you have personally lost, like there's a part of you that is now a loser. And what that means is that as our social identities become more related to our partisan identity, we're not really concerned about the policies that the government enacts as much as we are concerned about whether or not our team has won. And I liken it to something like sports team affiliation, where, you know, everybody sits together and watches the Super Bowl. After the Super Bowl, nobody cares what the team does. They watch it to get that sense of victory, to feel really good from that victory. And when we have this sort of team-based us versus them kind of approach to governing, the voters increasingly are satisfied with the win and don't feel the need to pay attention to the actual policies that the government is legislating.
I'm wondering, I mean, pick an issue, any of the issues that we're seeing, and we see, you know, child separation at the border, right? So you could have strong opinions about immigration policy, you could have strong opinions about, you know, what our border policy should be. But what stuns me, and I think what stuns a lot of people, is just how disdainful and how cruel some of the attitudes towards what's happening, particularly to families and children, and in this case, sexual assault victims with Christine Blasey Ford. It just seems that there's a cruelty and a lack of humanity and understanding, even at face value.
Right. This is partly because when we have these social divides and when we become able to start dehumanizing the other side, it sort of becomes a battle over grievances. Who is the victim? And if the victim is the children in the detention centers, then you have one set of positions. But if the victim is, as the Republican Party really pushed, you know, young people that were murdered by immigrants. So all that has to happen is for each side to change the label of which side is the victim. The same thing happened with the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, right? It's either Ford is the victim or Kavanaugh is the victim. And the two sides are not really fighting over the same question. They're fighting over who gets to be the aggrieved side. By distilling it into this very simple win versus lose contest, we end up missing a lot of the more important details.
We're not going to therapy as a country. What do we do?
Hopefully we have some new realignment. I think that may be one of the only ways. Either we have a change in our electoral system that allows sort of minor parties to start having more power so that we have sort of less of a zero-sum game. Or, like what happened in 1964, we have a major rift in one party that creates more decades of cross-cutting identities that are new and slightly confusing, which actually creates less polarization and less us versus them.
Oh, you can't say the United States is a boring place. Liliana Mason is an assistant professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. Liliana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Today is the voter registration deadline for one-third of the states across the country, from Arizona to Georgia to Illinois and beyond. So if you want to vote this November, this is your reminder to please go register. And leading up to Election Day, we've heard a lot about election meddling, whether by Russia, China, some guy in a basement, or otherwise. But what's not been in the media spotlight is ensuring fair access to the polls for everyone in the United States who wants to cast a ballot. Hurdles for voters are now getting thrown up across the country. Just this year, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit against Arizona, saying the state put more than 500,000 voters at risk of being disenfranchised. And in June, a federal judge struck down a Kansas law that required proof of citizenship to register to vote. It was deemed a violation of the National Voter Registration Act. Jessica Hoosman is here to tell us more. She's a reporter with ProPublica and the lead reporter for Electionland, a coalition of newsrooms covering problems with voting in 2018. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Help us understand what's happening here. We know that since 2016, there have been a couple of changes, as we mentioned at the top, affecting really voter disenfranchisement, who can and can't vote in this country. What have some of those changes been?
So there are a lot of states that have issued new voter ID laws, or there are states that have redrawn their voting boundaries to make it more difficult for your voice to be heard in terms of gerrymandering and making districts far more partisan than they once were. And this has sort of been a slow progression. States have also become a little bit more bold in terms of cleaning the voter rolls, and sometimes that crosses a line into purging. And so there have been a lot of actions, especially in the last 2 years, to make these things happen. So there's going to be, in this election, it's going to be the first time that a lot of these laws are in place, and we're expecting at least a little bit of confusion at the polls.
Let's talk about that, because we talked a little bit about, you know, cleaning and purging. What's the difference there between cleaning the voter rolls and purging the voter rolls? I think there are lots of civil rights activists who say this is really an effort to purge and keep communities of color and other folks off of the voter rolls. What are you seeing?
You know, I think that it really depends on who you ask. I think there's no election administrator, red, yellow, purple, green, that would tell you that voter roll maintenance is bad. I think we all have an interest in making sure that people who are no longer living in our communities or who are no longer eligible to vote for whatever reason remain on the voter roll. But there are states that do this in a particularly aggressive way that might make it more likely that a person who say doesn't check their mail very frequently or wouldn't know to respond to a specific mailer or doesn't vote regularly would be more likely to be purged from the voter roll. So, for example, the Houston case, which the Supreme Court decided just recently, allowed the state of Ohio to remove people from the roll if they didn't respond to a few mailers and also didn't vote in, I think, two elections. And so if you think about the people who are least likely to respond to a postcard that looks very much like junk mail, if we're being honest, and then also not regularly turn out to vote, those might be people who are minorities or the poor or the elderly who are least likely to vote anyway. And so they might be at higher risk for getting purged from the rolls. It really depends on who you ask, how severe they believe that problem is. If you talk to someone like the Brennan Center, they're going to tell you that it's a crisis. If you talk to someone like the Public Interest Legal Foundation, they're going to tell you it's good practice.
Good practice, but I want to push back a little bit there, because when I get a notice for jury duty, it's mm-hmm. clear what that notice is. I don't think anybody misses notices like that. Why aren't these notices clearer? They seem somewhat deceptive if you're taking people off the rolls and not making it clear that you've done that. I mean, isn't that somewhat anti-democratic?
So I think that that's not necessarily the case in a lot of states. The mailers, I agree, could be a lot clearer. But they do send the mailers more than one time over a period of a couple of years. That said, though, people are very likely to ignore them, even if they get them a couple of times. Like, I'm not sure that I would take a look at a postcard and realize that the consequence for not responding to it is that I might be removed from the voter roll.
Perhaps if the language was in huge, big, bold letters, as mm-hmm. it is when you get a jury summons, and it clearly says if you don't show up, you're getting right. arrested. I want to turn around for a second here, because what happens at the 2016 election? There were, and I covered this, there were lots of threats at the polls, or the fear of people being threatened when they showed up at the polls. People claiming to sort of want to implement these checks and balances when they got there. Are you seeing that for the midterms? Are there that many levels of concern in terms of who can and can't vote? You mentioned confusion at the polls. What's mm-hmm. that going to look like?
So I think that what we're more likely to see, and this was the case as well in 2016, we anticipated ahead of the 2016 election a lot of voter intimidation that was in the news every day. There were people actually actively making threats about intimidating voters at the poll and accosting them there. That didn't actually happen. In 2016, we only saw that a couple of very isolated locations and not for very long, and it didn't appear to be any sort of an organized effort. And so even if we start hearing sort of threats ahead of the midterm elections, I think that people should be really wary of the idea that someone's going to scream at them in front of their polling location. That is actually not a threat that we have seen. But the talk of that threat in exaggerating its likelihood would prevent some people from turning out to the poll. So I really want to stress that we did not see that in 2016, and we don't necessarily expect to see that in 2018. What we did see in 2016 and what we do anticipate seeing in 2018 is confusion around new laws. So, for example, in 2016, the Texas voter ID law was implemented, and it wasn't even necessarily that the law itself disenfranchised people, but because there was so confusion about what the law actually said
Step back a second. When you say it didn't actually disenfranchise people, a voter ID require you to have an ID? And a lot of people don't have that.
Right, it does. But in Texas in 2016, there was a reasonable impediment declaration that mm-hmm. you could fill out, and that was not appropriately implemented across the state. And so that and the misinformation in terms of what voters expected and what poll workers were trained to do disenfranchised quite a lot of people. And so we expect to see the same sort of confusion in 2018 around new laws.
Jessica Hoosman is a reporter with ProPublica and the lead reporter for ElectionLand. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And remember, listeners, today is the last day to register to vote in a bunch of states. So if you want to make your voice heard, please go register to vote. On Friday, a Chicago jury found Jason Van Dyke guilty of second-degree murder. Van Dyke was the white Chicago police officer who fatally shot 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, who was black, 16 times. For activists, this was an overdue victory. Just a small percentage of fatal police shootings in the United States result in arrests or charges against police officers. Criminologist Phil Stinson explained this on our show in August.
Between 900 and 1,000 times each and every year, an on-duty police officer shoots and kills someone at agencies all across the country. And by my count, 93 officers have been charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting since 2005. So it's very rare that an officer is charged at all, and it's even more rare that an officer is convicted.
Then, over the weekend, news broke that police officer Timothy Lohman, who shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice to death in Cleveland in 2014, has found a new job with the Police Department of Bel Air, Ohio, 2.5 hours outside of Cleveland. Greg Roby is a community activist and a former pastor in Martins Ferry, Ohio, which shares police with Nextdoor Bel Air. Greg, welcome to The Takeaway.
How you doing?
When you hear from people in your community about the hiring of Timothy Lohman, what are they saying?
Oh, they're very appalled. It's outrageous. Most people are horrified, and most people are hurt and bewildered, and a lot of people are confused and mind boggled. But honestly, it doesn't surprise me from being from this area and the things that have gone on even in the past. Something similar to this. I just feel like the system is very sick and they're infected with incompetency.
One of the things that we should note here is that police officer Lohman was fired from the police department in Cleveland. And before that, from the police department in Independence, Ohio. He was not fired, however, for the killing of Tamir Rice. He was fired for lying on his job application. And then he was cleared of all wrongdoing in the case. Does that do anything to alleviate any concerns about hiring him?
It is horrific. It blows my mind to the point where how can an officer have in his files that he lied, for one, like you said, he had incidents of insubordination, inability to emotionally function, and he was labeled as unfit to serve, and then our city has the audacity to even consider hiring somebody that is inadequate and unqualified and deficient. Maybe the chief of police here should be getting his background checked.
What's interesting is that we did reach out to the Bel Air Police Department for comment, and they did not respond. But the chief of police who hired Lohman, his name is Richard Flanagan, said it's not fair to, quote unquote, crucify Lohman. Your reaction?
That is horrible, but I can understand that it comes from somebody like that. When you can go on YouTube and look up Mr. Dick Flanagan and look up Officer Flanagan screaming profanities at a person, there's a video out about that in 2014. I don't think he ever got reprimanded for it. He shows that he abuses his power. He cusses at people. He the way that he is, it doesn't surprise me not one bit. When he says that he wants to hire officers to be proactive, what does he mean by that? Shouldn't that be hiring someone to stop things before it happens? But he's obviously hiring somebody that already has done some things. He talks about second chances. This officer had second and third chances, and that's not right. That's not correct, and it's something to be concerned about. But it's a mindset that is here in these small cities. It's a mindset, something that's going on. I mean, Tom Junkins was a former deputy sheriff here in 1973, and he was quoted saying, "I don't see anything wrong with this at all."
Greg, if that's the case, what is the Black community and maybe even the extended community doing to change that? Are there efforts to litigate this issue? Are there efforts to get more people turning out to the polls for smaller elections to change the leadership? What can be done at this point?
Well, there's two things. One is the Black community as a whole, and I hate to say it, but it's the truth. Well, they do not unite enough to be able to come together as one and stand against something. But it's also out of fear, and especially when you're dealing with the Bel Air Police Department and the chief of police down there with the reputation that he has. Yes, they'll rally. Yes, we will rally as a community, a Black community, for a minute. But when it comes to really put some work in, it's sad to say we won't stay unified. And that's why it gets swept right back under the rug. It's been like this since I'm 41 years old, so since I was born.
Greg Roby is a community activist and former pastor in Martins Ferry, Ohio, and he's also the owner of Mastermind Manifesto Life Coaching. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
We want you to be part of The Takeaway's Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our conversation every day. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram. We're at The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.